Accession number 11486, rule 5.
There was a difference in rationing between the heavily bombed town and the eastern areas that were not bombed, I don't know. It seems quite possible. We must certainly had extra rations here and there. But it wasn't really a problem. My mother cooked quite well. I was never really interested in cooking at the time, but she coped.
Did you have any sort of campaigns, government campaigns, like we had in Britain? There was one Dig for Victory, where everyone was exhorted to dig up their lawns and plant potatoes or what have you. And another one was Make, Do and Mend, you know, which was to make garments out of old scraps or alter things. Was there anything like that, any government-led scheme?
I think it's because we probably did some of that anyway. The people did have a lot of vegetables and stuff in their garden. The Germans don't go in for lawns quite the same as Britain because the climate isn't that suitable. We dug up our lawn after the war for sugar beet. One tended to make things out of old things because our clothes rationing was very tight. You didn't get coupons. You had to go and apply to buy a coat and shoes. You didn't have points at all. So clothing was tight from the word go. I mean, you made your own curtains into dresses simply because you wanted a new dress, and certain things for free, or silky things or so on, which were available for a bit and one had. But no, I can't remember a government-led campaign except that one had to, in general, had to make use of everything, but then one simply did it. I was just thinking about a collection of rubbish. It wasn't a problem. There wasn't anything. Vegetable refuse went on the heap. Paper, etc., was hardly available, and one took it and collected it. There were really only the ashes, which one threw into a bomb hole if there was one present, it was still collected till later on in the war, but not every week, occasionally. So that didn't enter a problem nowadays, it just didn't exist.
Would it have been at this time when this school was evacuated?
Yes, we were evacuated in May 43, and in fact the day after the dams were burst, the Möhne Dam.
We ought to talk about that first, I think, don't you?
Yes.
You can remember, you know, what you can remember of that.
I remember that night very vividly. As I said, our house was partially destroyed, so I stayed with some friends, and very funnily enough, the lady was English. She'd married the German prior to World War I, close friend of my mother's, and I stayed there, and husband always used to rage against the English bombing, and his wife used to say, "Oh, just calm down." Very amusing, really. They were very happily married for 60 years. And as we were all distributed all over the town, I thought, "Oh, well, I'll want to talk to my sister." So I used to go to the various bunkers and see whether she was somewhere, because she was sleeping somewhere else, and my mother was again somewhere else. And that night, we, of course, ourselves didn't have a raid because it went on to the Möhne Dam and the Edertalsperre. And we were up the whole night. We knew we would be evacuated the next day, so we didn't want to go anyway. And it was a hot night, and there was an air raid alarm all night. We had the alarm, although we didn't have any bombs. And we were up all night, walking around and talking. It was most extraordinary. And then we heard this the next day, and there was no water. And we were all absolutely terrified, because they said if there's now going to be an incendiary raid, the fire brigade can't come out because there just isn't any water. And we had to leave. We left the next day for our evacuation to the Baltic that day, and we were all absolutely petrified that this would happen to our parents. We sort of left them on a boiling hot day, knowing, my God, if there's going to be an air raid, that's going to be it. But that didn't happen. So that's why I remember that particular night and the anxieties quite well, as it just then happened. Yes, we were put on a special train.
It's before you go on your evacuation, mm-hmm. if I could ask you a little more about the dam. You know, was that a surprise that someone had actually managed to bomb it? Did you think that it was vulnerable? Was it a big thing when it happened?
No, one just accepted things got bombed, and that was yet another thing. It wasn't the whole town, it was something that got bombed. It didn't occur to me at the time what a clever thing it was to actually get a bomb onto it. And I don't suppose anything was made of it. It was just that it was bombed, and I accepted it as such. And that's the way it was presented as well, I feel. So it was, of course, quite a big thing here. Mind you, I think it was... I don't know whether it was repaired, but it didn't keep people without water for that length of time. They somehow made alternative arrangements, it seemed, and water was restored.
So now where you're going off into your evacuation period, Inna?
Yes, to the Baltic coast, and we knew we would go to the Baltic, a little island called Rügen, just off the coast, which is now going to be part of Germany again. It was part of the DDR for the last 45 years. Yes, we were put in a special train. We were considered, I think, always precious cargo, young people in Germany. I think we were quite well treated. And we had this, seemed rather a long journey, because we were a special train. We probably took longer getting up there. To the island, which is a beautiful holiday resort type of island, where we were distributed in a town there, or a spa, the whole school with teachers, and we were put into hotels. We had rather charming, we have a small form, had a very pleasant, charming little guest house place with our teacher, and we were taught in that place. So during that last three quarters of a year of my teaching, one had any science in theory only. So obviously no experiments were possible. We carried on with all the other lessons. I suppose it's quite possible to teach with a minimum of equipment, if you really want to teach. And we settled down to it. I personally remember the time at Rügen relatively happily. It was a lovely place. We were just, our form was by itself, and we all got on quite well. We only had two Nazis amongst the lot, and we all knew who they were. We were supposed to have, or we all had, a Hitler Youth young person, Führerin, in the house as well, who was supposed to look after our political well-being. But she was quite nice, and we got on quite well with her and took no notice of her. She was supposed to do this, that, and the other with us political, but nobody bothered, and so we didn't. And it was not such a bad time, really. We had some time swimming. The Baltic's rather lovely. We had a nice teacher who we made journeys and trips with to other parts of the island. We were the oldest form, which is always a good thing to be. So we had advantages that way. And we were there from May to the end of August, when we were taken down to Austria. We had a few little rebellions, I remember, in a very sort of, I suppose, really quite childish way. We had to, every morning, one form had to raise the flag. And so you had to march there and raise the flag and sing a song and come back again. And when it was our turn, we made an absolute point of not marching, sort of going slouching there and standing underneath slouching and not singing a proper song and slouching back, which obviously was remarked upon. And we got sort of into bad odour, and we, on big assemblies, we didn't do as we were told and stood up and said, no, we won't. And as I was girl in, what you call her, the club form captain, I had to appear before the headmaster and to justify our behaviour, which I couldn't, of course. I just talked, hooked round it, but he was a nasty piece of work, actually. And we obviously had a very bad political report. You were politically reported on, because although it was the school evacuated, there were the party authorities also had a say, and they were represented, and they were to see that we all behaved in a proper National Socialist way, and they had to make a report, and they made a very negative report on us. So when we came to Austria, that negative report followed us, and we were already received with thus and told how to behave, which it seems incredible. Well, at the time, I was scared, because the threat was always, if you don't behave, you can't do your A-levels. And just after all those years, half a year before the A-levels, she really wanted some, so that was a threat. And so one left off misbehaving on political matters, as it were. It was frightening. We had, when we were in Austria, in fact, we found the Austrian party officials extremely unpleasant and threatening. Immediately when we came, we were told that we'd had a bad report. This is our form, our 15 people. And they, in fact, brought two party officials in uniform down. I don't know what they were. I suppose one was SS, the other was something else. And they grilled us. And I remember they quoted things we had said, anti-Hitler things, which in fact we had said. I remembered saying them, so I knew this. But when they grilled you, we were all together. It was said to be a bit of a social meeting, but it, of course, wasn't. So you talk to someone like this, and then there would be someone behind you always listening to it and sort of making signals to the person asking you, which is most disconcerting. Always somebody watching you from another side. So we managed, we were simply saying it's not true, and I didn't, and talking round it and involving them in conversation. And I suppose they were a little bit on a soft, they weren't quite, they weren't in a strong position, because we were German children, not Austrian. And I don't think they wanted any trouble with children from the Ruhrgebiet, because that would have upset all the parents, and that wouldn't have been a good thing. But there was definitely the threat, if you don't behave, there are places where we can make you behave. And the form was split up, and we were didn't do any more. I mean, this was sort of unbehaved and got one W2 and said the right thing in the examinations, the things one was expected to say, and one jolly well knew one was expected to say. They were ridiculous, but one did. And that was a sort of brush with authority. And it's very frightening, and this was nothing compared, obviously, with what real resistance to Nazism had to go through. It is, I think, direct sort of physical violence, to me, is a very terrifying thing. I've always been terrified of that. And it seemed sort of close and possible, and so one simply was careful in what one said after that.
What sort of things had you said about Hitler and others?
Oh, we'd said, oh, it doesn't really matter. Let's have the war. Let the war be ended. One can have a jolly good time with the French and English as well. Only things like that. That style of thing, which was considered to be very unpatriotic and all that goes with it. But it showed, I suppose, a basic attitude. One had not marched, one had said that, one had laughed at some, there was some SS opposite at some stage, and one had laughed at their antics and or marching on this type of thing, which showed one's attitude very clearly, I suppose. The school, our teachers very much held their hand over us and helped us along. It was no problem, as much as they could. And I suppose the whole idea was not to make much of it because we were only there temporary and we were not Austrians, we were German children.
And so after evacuation, did this mean going back to your hometown?
Yes, we did our Abitur, which is the equivalent to the A-level there, and unfortunately we would then be called up for Arbeitsdienst. We had to do half a year's service to the state if you before you went to university. We went all home, but we were called up to do it down in Austria again. So we travelled back home and then were called up a month or two later and travelled back again. Always long journeys. It seems nothing now, but it was always 24 hours. Most uncomfortable, but that was, I mean, it was in, don't think much of that when you're young. And I was allocated to a place in southern Czechoslovakia. It seemed very eastern. Sort of the atmosphere of the place. It was all wide areas and not much growing. It seemed extraordinarily eastern to me. And before you were actually put into uniform, it was a sort of khaki uniform went with this, you were taken once more to a doctor for medical, when it had lots of medicals, but just before. And some sort of guardian angel must have been there for me, because once I was alone with the doctor, who actually was a Russian, a white Russian or something like that, he made a very sort of innocuous remark. He said, "Now then, tell me everything that's wrong with you." Now, you could have interpreted that and say, "Oh, well, I'm perfectly fit," but I knew what he meant. And so I said, "Oh, yes, I've got my nose is constantly blocked up and I've got something wrong with my periods and I can't eat this, that and the other and I have trouble here, there and everywhere." I was a very fit person, actually. And he said, "Oh, well, yes, of course, we can't have this. We must send you to specialists." So no sooner was I there, I was sent a week to Vienna to see these specialists all by myself. It was extraordinary thing, really. I didn't know where I'd stay. I stayed in some headquarters for a night or two, and then there wasn't room. And I stayed in places for the homeless sort of thing, for a mark a night. Weird. Nobody knew where I was. And during the day, I went to the hospitals and to various places where one could just sit and have a cup of coffee. And again, you notice immediately with the doctors, those who were keen to help you or make it appear that you were ill, then you wouldn't have to do that service. They would ask the right questions and do the right tests. And so two of the doctors, the internist, the one who looked at my stomach and gave me barely a meal, and the one with the nose, they said, "Oh, yes, you have to have an operation for the nose that has to be tended to." And the other one says, "You have to live on a diet." And the gynecologist said, "Oh, all is well." He was a nasty piece of work. He was rough and horrible. And so I got that report. And that meant I took it back to headquarters of the Arbeitsdienst. And they said, "Right, we can't have you now. You're deferred for half a year." And so I collected my bag and went back home. And my parents were absolutely horrified because they thought I'd run away. But I had this half year time to get better. The only good thing in Vienna was that I had the chance once, somebody got tickets for the state opera, so I saw the most fantastic performance of Rosenkavalier amidst all that. It was sort of an odd thing. This was before it was destroyed. And then I knew once you were deferred for half a year, you could start studying at a university for 3 semesters, which is a year and a half. You couldn't take exams. But by this time, we had 44 in April. I then knew that probably the war wouldn't last that long. That was worth doing. So I went to Heidelberg, where I always wanted to go, and immatriculated, which is easier in Germany. It was then, because once you have Abitur, you can immatriculate at any university for anything. My father took me, and I sort of spent 3 months of bliss in Heidelberg. As soon as I arrived there, I knew I wouldn't be able to study more than one semester because they said universities would be closed for the first semesters. A school friend of mine was there as well, and so one didn't do much work, and one simply had a good time, I must say, in all honesty. Everybody said, well, it's positively antisocial to work during the first semester. Nobody does. Also, it was a completely undestroyed town, so it was rather lovely. I don't think a bomb had fallen there. Everybody always says Churchill's grandmother likes it, or this was a sort of funny tale. I think the Americans probably did, because they had it as their headquarters later on. The roses were blooming. One simply lived for the day. The carpe diem, live for the day, that was really the motto. There were plenty of there were people studying, men studying as well, but they were all medics because they were allowed to study or finish their studies. They were in uniform, as it were, but were allowed to study. And, of course, some who already were wounded and back studying, and a lot of girls. And I studied languages. And it seemed to me to be constantly having parties and going to dances, and the weather was lovely. And I lived in a hotel. David and I have been to that hotel since. It's changed in some respects. We couldn't live anywhere else. And we sort of had an incredible time. If I think about it, there was a war all around, and there were just those 3 months of freedom, as it were, freedom from real worry, because there were no air raids. Food didn't matter, money didn't matter. My father was always delighted to send money. He said, "I'm glad you know how to spend some money." And it was a free and easy, very free and easy atmosphere, I suppose, much as student life might be now, as it were. Lots of general boyfriends. I was amused at present-day people when they sort of think one lived almost sort of like a nun in those days. The idea of getting you into bed was exactly as it is now. There's no difference whatsoever, and it was up to you to not, as it were, because of course in those days. The fear was having a baby or VD, needless to say. I don't think much has changed, really, since then.
It's interesting you sort of raising that topic, because, you know, obviously you're now a young woman, aren't you? You're coming up 18.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain during the war, it was often said, you know, that because of the war situation and transient relationships, that the sort of moral situation was very different, the sort of sexual mm-hmm. worries. Would you say that happened in Germany from your experience? Was this feeling that, you know, live for today?
Yes, very much so. And the men who went back to the front, I think, also felt this very strongly. And I think there was with the young man, it's probably the feeling that they wanted to perpetuate themselves because the chances of not coming back were quite large. So there were quite a few children born, no doubt, out of wedlock as well, but most certainly in wedlock. And yes, the live for the day, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, was strong, I think. I found it quite a natural thing, really, because you didn't know what was going to happen tomorrow. And the chances of actually getting killed were quite high, even for us. So, yes, one lived like that. One did one's bit as well, obviously. I didn't those 3 months. I don't think I did a lot of work. I did some. And another extraordinary thing, Heidelberg was full of foreigners. I couldn't believe it. There were Turks, Persians, there was a Yugoslav, French, Luxembourg. They were all studying there at the university. So we were quite a mixed bunch of people in an extraordinary way, really. I'm quite sure there was a lot of spying going on and people being there. It was a sort of odd feeling occasionally that my friend, for instance, was suddenly very much photographed from... she noticed she had been photographed and she was invited to a place where she was... where she was asked whether she was someone, an ambassador's daughter, which she wasn't, but she wasn't quite believed. It was a sort of odd setting. I remember I was once picked up after a very general lecture, psychology, which everybody went to. You know, the German system is a little different at universities. You can go to whichever lecture you like, and masses of people went to psychology lecture. Well, I hadn't been in it. And I was sitting, however, in the sort of big hall, and I was approached by a man. I don't know if he was older, but I don't know, quite attractive, but didn't really matter. And he said, oh, he'd watched me in the lecture, and he wondered whether we could meet. Now, I knew he couldn't have seen me there, and I sort of wondered why he said that, because could have picked me up any time, wanted to. So I said yes, the way one is. And we made a date, and he said all the time he didn't want to be seen. And would I not be late? So I did, and we went for a walk. Heidelberg's that sort of place where you go for a walk. It was dark then. And he didn't want me as a person. I mean, you know whether somebody's sexually interested in you or not. He wasn't particularly. And he asked all sorts of questions, political questions, and they were so phrased that you didn't know whether he was a spy or he could have been Gestapo. They would be the same questions. So as you don't know, you answer very carefully. And we made another date to which he didn't turn up. Now, I never in all my life knew what he really wanted. It's a sort of mystery. It did happen just after the 20th July, 44. So he may well have been someone who wanted an evening's cover. I don't know. I have no... It's just a thought. I mean, he may have been a spy. There must have been people wanting to know what the German population thought and the students thought. He may well have been a Gestapo man having had some bad political report trying. You can't tell. So this is a sort of atmosphere. It was an odd atmosphere. But that was just one thing of which the boyfriends at the time were all medics, and that was quite straightforward, sort of.
What was the reaction to the July plot? And the fate of those, you know, involved? Your reaction?
Was your group? One did hear some of it.